This is an ABC podcast. On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Welcome to a comedic conversation hour today, but one with a bit of... Well, look, there might be some tears as well as the laughter. Mind you, good comedy makes you cry and laugh. So that's why our guests are so apt in the joining of their different talents for today's conversation hour. Maz Durrani is a superstar in the American comedic scene, a regular on all sorts of famous TV and stage shows, and he's touring around and joins us on the conversation hour in the studio shortly. Corey White is a local whose work you may have seen at the Comedy Festival, where a few years ago he won the Best Newcomer Award. He's now become a staple on the comedy scene. He's been on Australian Story. He's written a book now called The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory. It is unbelievably tragic and sad, his upbringing, but he's turned it to his comedic advantage. Not unlike my co-host, Sammy Shah, who is the breakfast host here on ABC Radio, and last night was doing overtime working on ABC TV on Q&A, which has not deterred him from putting in extra hours on the conversation hour today. Morning to you, Sammy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Did you survive Q&A?
I did. I didn't end up having to leave the country or close down my social media or just being railroaded out of society because of something I said. So I think, you know, for a Q&A appearance, that's quite a win.
So you're in the office at what time in the morning?
3 a.m.
3 a.m. yesterday.
I reached the office at 4:30. Sorry.
So you're here at 4:30. Mm-hmm. And then you were still here at...
So I went home in the afternoon.
Yeah,
had a nap.
Came back
here around 8:30 p.m.
Went on air at 9:30.
Till
10:30.
Then after that, there were drinks and a little bit of schmoozing and business card exchanging, which I wanted to stick around for because why not?
So you left here at what time?
I left at 11:30.
And came back again at?
4:30. Yeah.
And you're still here now?
Yes.
How's your energy level?
So far, so good. Luckily, I don't require much sleep anyway. So I'm a 4-hour person, 4 hours a day person.
Just
most
once,
days.
4 hours?
Yes. I can do 4 hours and then I'm good for a year. And then I crash on a weekend. But so far I'm fine. What will happen is after this, I'll go home and I will disappear so deep into sleep that there won't even be REM. There will just be blackness. And then I'll come out of that a few hours later.
For what? For the evening?
For the evening.
And
for
then
cooking.
Go to sleep again.
And then I'll be up till around 9:30, 10, prepping for the show and doing all that.
And did you enjoy Q&A? Because I must say it's become a bit predictable and formulaic.
So I'll be honest, I haven't seen a single episode in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
My episode, I haven't seen either because I was on it.
In it.
Right. And on it or in it?
In it.
All right. I'll take your word for that. And so it's the kind of format which I'm not particularly addicted to watching because, you know, it's a soundbite, 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 next topic, same kind of thing. Usually it ends up with the politicians fighting amongst each other and everyone else kind of watches.
And who was on with you? Linda Burney?
Linda Burney.
Who is the Labor shadow minister for...
I don't know what her portfolio
Indigenous
is.
Indigenous affairs and other things.
That's right.
Former member of the New South Wales State Parliament. The government was represented by...
Well, kind of, sort of represented in that Jim Molan was there.
He's still a senator.
Yes, but doesn't have a seat with the government.
Well, he's a senator who's lost, he eventually will lose his seat in the parliament, but wants to stay on.
Yes.
Right? Yep. Very outspoken, former senior defence general, I think he was.
That's right. And he wrote a couple of books about his time in Iraq and Afghanistan. Yep.
So Linda Burney, Jim Molan.
There's
Sammy
Rebecca
Sharkey. Rebecca Sharkey.
Centre Alliance.
Yep. Former Xenophon ticket.
Yes.
Yep.
And
now independent. Yep.
And there was Toby Ralph, who is a marketing guru who's spent time in developing nations doing marketing stuff for things like elections in Afghanistan and stuff.
Did you get all your gags in?
I tried to keep it gag minimal because I find that if you put too many gags, ABC audiences go, look, this isn't a clown show. You can do your stand-up somewhere else. So one or
two
gags.
How do you know that if you haven't watched it for 4 years?
Because I know ABC audiences because I speak to them every morning and they call me up every morning.
That's a different audience. That's your breakfast radio show audience. Q&A audience. They love a good gag.
Yeah, well, they laughed. There was definitely a little bit of laughter. I don't know if it was on purpose or inadvertent, but there was definitely laughter once or twice.
Yeah.
And I could live with that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
And did you get in some of your kind of, you know...
My jabs?
Super good points that no one else had ever thought of?
Oh, I don't know. But part of what happens is some of this becomes a blur. Like, you'll do it, and then you have no idea what you said, and then later people will either say, oh, you really stuffed that up, or, oh, you survived that, and then you just walk away going, oh, couldn't have been too bad.
Or you get that whole thing where later on you think of the great line you wish you'd thought of at the time.
Oh, yeah, that.
Didn't quite come up with.
There was a bit of that last night when I was going to bed, where it was like, there was one thing I wish I'd said, but no one asked me, so I couldn't have gotten it.
Why didn't I get that?
Yes.
Now, tell me about your pending nuptials. You're getting married.
I am indeed. I am indeed. Yes, a second time. So I was married before, and then I just stopped doing that. This would have been, I got married in 2005. We ended around 2013 or 2012. Yeah, 2013 would be right.
7 years.
Yeah. From there, we're still friends. We live right next to each other in terms of our lanes. We live one lane away, my ex-wife and I, and we raise a daughter together. We co-parent. We have a 10-year-old together. And then 3 years ago, I met someone wonderful here in Melbourne. And so she and I are doing what we call a budget Stefanovic, in that we can't afford Mexico. We can't afford Julia Bishop. So instead, we're going to Phuket, and we're just affording my family. And her family, and they'll be there in September. So
your family are still many of them in Pakistan?
That's right. So their
family are here in Australia?
Yes, they're all Melbourne-based.
So you had to choose somewhere halfway?
Just the midpoint, which is also palatable to everyone in terms of food, and most importantly, my budget, which is minimal. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, being an ABC broadcaster. And so we're kind of done this thing where we're all meeting over there. We're going to spend 3-4 days there. There'll be a South Asian wedding, and then there'll be a Western wedding, both one day apart. Both in Phuket.
So you can get a local celebrant.
Yes. And that's the interesting thing. We found for my parents, they wanted a imam. So we found a mosque imam over there, and then for her parents, they wanted a priest. So we found a priest over there, and we shall do this.
Since when do parents dictate what happens at your wedding?
Deep down, I'm still Pakistani. You know, you can take the boy out of Pakistan, but you can't take his parents out of his life. So they still dictate things, and that's just the way it is.
But
you don't
fight
it.
You're not at all religious or observant.
Not at all.
But you're still going to go through two religious ceremonies.
Because it matters to them.
Neither of which you believe in.
Yes, because it matters to them. Because for them, the symbolism of it is so important that for me, it becomes a worthwhile exercise. It's no skin off my nose, but it makes them happy. And, you know, it's that thing.
Why is it no skin off your nose to pretend to be something you're not, which is a person who believes in the service that you're participating in? Where I could not do what you're doing.
Right.
I'm sure it would have made my parents very happy if I'd had a religious wedding, but I didn't,
mm-hmm.
because it would have been completely foreign to me and my
right.
beliefs and also Jan's, so we didn't.
Yes.
But you're able to accommodate on both sides, her family and your family.
Mm-hmm. I think part of it comes from having grown up in a more religious society like Pakistan than Australia would have been. So growing up in Australia, and I'm just guessing here, even if you come from a religious community or religious family, it's a fairly secular-ish society.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Pakistan, religion is so deeply ingrained in every fiber and every aspect of your life, you can become an atheist or step away from it, but there'll always be rituals and such which hold cultural importance to you or have some weight upon you.
And you can be nostalgic about it without necessarily complying or conforming.
Well, so here's the way I did the math in my head, which is if I go through with this process.
If I don't go through with this and I get disinherited and she doesn't go through with it and she gets disinherited, then that is financially catastrophic, so we better do the right thing by our respective parents.
Unfortunately, neither of our sides of our families have much to offer us in terms of the inheritance amounts. What we did decide, though, was, again, neither of us particularly care about the religious aspect, but since it means so much to the others, we're like, all right, look, we'll do this for you. And
we'll
then maybe
indulge the parents.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that way you will be more appreciative of what we're doing for you and for one stop saying our kids never do anything for us.
So what does your daughter think?
She's a big fan.
Because of both weddings?
Yes, because she gets the Western wedding, which she's excited about. And more importantly, she gets a Pakistani wedding as well, which she's very excited about.
Which is kind of crazy, yeah.
She obviously missed the first Pakistani wedding because she wasn't born at the time. But yeah, she gets that kind of, you know, multicultural experience, which is reflecting of her own life story now, because she's half Pakistani, half Australian.
You don't have to answer this, but does your ex-wife go to your next wedding?
I invited her, of course, because we do get along, and she's traveling elsewhere at the time. So she said she can't make it, which, you know, that's for propriety's sake and such.
Very exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm looking quite forward to
it. Yeah, yeah. Well, and apart from anything else, you get a holiday in Thailand.
I do get that. And I think, you know, you learn from the mistakes of your first wedding, not what not to do in the second one. That's my theory, and I'm sticking to it. Don't give me statistics about how second marriages don't work. Please. Thank you. Continue.
Sammy Shah, my co-host. I'm John Fain. And comedian Corey White years ago decided he would chance his arm at doing a little bit of stand-up comedy. And it's led to great success, and now not just an appearance on ABC TV's Australian Story, but also a book, a memoir. The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory is the title that Corey has chosen for his remarkable tale of arriving out of adversity and surviving a foster care system and a family that's about as dysfunctional as it can possibly be. Corey, good morning to you.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me.
If you made up your life story, no one would believe you.
No, no, they wouldn't. Luckily, I've got a whole paper trail from a massive bureaucracy to back it up. Yeah.
And the bureaucracy being which one?
The Department of Child Safety in Queensland, yeah.
And the reason there's a paper trail is?
I grew up in foster care, and basically I was in and out of the system from the age of 8 months old, in fact.
Because
my parents were drug addicts, yeah.
Your father you met up with much later in life.
Yes, that's right.
A much diminished figure, but the violence with which he visited upon your family is also a substantial feature of what went wrong.
Yes, certainly. There was a lot of domestic violence, which was informed by drug use, obviously some misogynistic attitudes, and then a good dose of mental illness was thrown in there too. So an interesting mixture of pretty dysfunctional things. Yeah.
Pretty typical for comedians, really, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, I was gifted so many great premises, as I said, in the project.
No comedian's happy when their life is happy. So yeah. you've just really gotten the edge.
Right? I've got the edge.
Unfair, actually.
Yeah, well, actually, I think you have some advantages too, like I do. I think that often the best comedy lies in the toughest circumstances. I think there's a natural human need to laugh off really tense, perhaps depressing or anxiety-inducing things. And
so
I think that's
therapy,
where
therapy, performance is therapy.
No, I don't subscribe to that idea. I think that's a bit naff.
Is it a compulsion?
Yes, I think you would agree, right? You just have to get up there. There is something fundamentally wrong with us.
Mm-hmm.
The dopamine receptors didn't quite bind in the womb or something. But, you know, I think, I mean, it's funny.
I have a theory which is has been solidified over the years based on conversations with many other comedians,
sure.
Is stand-up comedy comes from absent fathers.
Okay.
And reading your book, that doesn't dispute my theory at all.
No, it backs it up very well.
In a way, we're just asking the audience for hugs from daddy.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe there's something to that. It's a simple, elegant theory. More research needs to be done.
Let's turn it around. But there's lots of people with absent parents and fathers and mothers who don't become comedians.
Sure. But...
So the Venn diagram does not completely overlap.
No.
No. There's other dysfunctions needed, clearly.
Yeah.
But look, because in this book, there's no shortage of dysfunctional moments or influences on offer. So, you know, like you mentioned, your parents are both drug addicts. From there, you go into foster care. From there, you end up in different families which treat you terribly. There is sexual assault in there.
Mm-hmm.
There is all of these topics and all of these issues that would be just enough grist for one book, and they're all in the first 10 chapters of
this
book. Telling this story, making this story palatable and also in some ways funny, was that traumatic?
No, not at all. I think it wasn't quite therapy. But there were healing elements to it. I think there's a natural human desire to tell stories and to make sense of your life in a narrative form. But I think this was rather, this wasn't traumatizing. I think this was the end point of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
This represented a final stage in the evolution from someone who saw themselves as a victim, as I did when I was younger, to someone who sees themselves as a human being with some pretty wicked party stories. You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's drinks that can be bought on these.
Yes, exactly.
Right, fair enough.
But then the process of writing it all down, revising it, editing it, checking it,
mm-hmm.
spell checking it, proofreading it, mm-hmm. publishing it, promoting it,
Telling the story around again and again.
Going around the country, answering people's questions about it.
Sure.
Makes it fairly hard to kind of leave it behind and put it into a compartment or a box and say, okay, that was then and this is now.
I mean, it's always more complicated. In the book, I did a great stand-up show, which sort of was quite popular, which led to, you know, an offer of my own TV series and this book. And there was a breakdown there that was perhaps triggered by the success. But the book was really written up at the end of all that. And I'd like to think now, you know, I'm in a great state, and I enjoy connecting with people who have these similar sorts of experiences and finding them resonate with those people. I enjoy talking to people and hearing other stories through my story now.
Yeah. So this makes you more resilient, is what you're telling
us. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I really, not to call it too early, but I think I feel like I'm at a stage in my life where I'm interested in connection with others. Mm-hmm. It's beyond myself so much. I mean, this is my story, but what I'm really enjoying about, the reviews so far and people's responses to advanced copies is how they connect to the material and what they're bringing to the text and having those conversations.
Writing's a very solitary experience. Maybe the need for connection comes from having gone through that solitary experience for such a prolonged period of time.
Perhaps, yeah. I'm not quite sure. To me, it's like an itch that must be scratched.
Yes.
I don't think there's any logic or reason to it. I just must do it. Maybe there is that impulse to tell stories, but you're in the shower and you have like a line that you think is beautiful and you find yourself writing it down, and maybe this will be useful in the future. It's like you're hoarding language jewels that occur to you as you're washing your armpits. There's a kind of, I guess I'm always fascinated
with
language.
The muse strikes in weird me.
In strange ways, you know, one's on a bus and, you know, someone farts and you're like, oh, what about that? How could I describe
that's
that?
That's how Proust's novel started. Yeah. That's right, yes. That's right.
So,
he smelt a Madeleine. Okay, so you told this story first as stand-up, then you told it in a TV show on ABC, a documentary series.
Well, not so much. I think that I told a lot of what was in the show is not in this. There's maybe one story that's in the book from that stand-up show. That stand-up show was more sort of abstract and philosophical. It was concerned with like a key idea of Plato, something that he said. But this is very different to that. And I see the TV show as quite different, more political than anything. This is very personal, very literary.
How do you approach the three? How do you decide, you know what, the stand-up show won't be as personal, it'll be philosophical. The documentary series will be something else, and the book will be the personal without the philosophical, or have it rolled in?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think there was much cognition happening. I just went on instinct with, I think different forms pull out different ideas from you. I think stand-up has an inbuilt limit to how deep you can go into ideas. It's weird if a stand-up comedian is trying to say beautiful things, whereas when you write, you're often trying to get across a some sort of aesthetic excellence. Mm-hmm. You're striving for rhythms that are beautiful, whereas in stand-up, you're striving for rhythms that are
Surprising or shocking.
Or shocking. And then in a TV series that's political, you're not striving for rhythms at all. You're striving for ideas. I think it's difficult to explain.
This is your family's story. It's your personal perspective on what happened in a whole family. So do you need to somehow align your recollections with those of your various siblings, half-siblings, foster siblings, foster parents, the various people whose paths you've crossed and whose stories you're also telling?
I think in this book, it's very narrow. I mean, there was a large stretch of my life where I was incredibly solipsistic. And going back and actually reading this book, there's a lot of the time where I'm tuning out everything else. I don't have contact with a lot of those people that I grew up with and had those experiences with now.
Siblings?
I do. However, one's always aware that they're at different places in their healing and their sense of peace with things, and so you don't want to dig too deeply. You don't want to re-traumatise them or trigger them, to use a much maligned word.
To put it in its simplest terms, are they okay?
They are okay, yeah. Without going into to too much detail about other people's lives.
No, we respect their privacy, but yes. Their stories are told by proxy.
Yes. I tried. It's tough. It's because you want to respect other people's mm-hmm. privacy, but you also know that there's a sense in which their stories are interlaced with yours, and they are okay with what's in the book. Yeah, I have checked particular elements of the story with my sisters and others that I was able to.
The book's called The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory. Why the title?
I just thought it was a nice title. I thought it was kind of funny, morbid, beautiful. And I think it captures one of the themes in the book, this idea of trying to win in a doomed system, mm-hmm. Of this sort of self-destructive desire for success in various fields.
Mm.
Yeah.
You could have come up with about 5,000 other ways of describing it, I might say. It is, as Sammy said, it is astonishing. And as you read episode after episode, mm-hmm. that would have been enough to break many people, if not most people, mm-hmm. and you look at what butterfly has emerged... Rather than prettiest
John.
Horse, the butterfly that's
yes.
emerged.
It's the most flirtatious he's ever got.
From the cocoon. Well, no, clearly. I mean, Corey, you found your place.
Mm-hmm.
You found your voice. You found a career, and many others would never have been able to do so. So we are all the better for the fact that you're able not just to do what you do, but you're able to tell us these stories to lift the lid on some of the appalling things that have gone on. And we're talking about as appalling as it gets. Mm. I'm not wanting... I don't want to turn this into a horror show.
Yeah, of course
but
not.
But if people imagine the worst possible things that can happen to kids and then pretty much double it and then add some more.
Which is what makes this book so unique to me, because it's not the kind of thing which I would recommend people seek out, for example. Normally, I'd say, there's a lot of trauma in the book, very difficult subject matter, avoid it if you have a gentle constitution. The thing that elevates it and makes it work is the writing.
Mm.
The language, your facility for language in this and your ability to turn a phrase is so poetic that it turns those moments of trauma into moments of literary achievement. Mm. Who are your influences?
A whole host.
I was supposed to say Sammy Shah.
Well, Sammy Shah, the whole body of humanity.
Oh, thank you. That came from another.
Franz Kafka was...
And Sammy Shah.
So Franz Kafka, Richard Yates, Carson McCullers, John Kennedy Toole, Ecclesiastes, oddly enough.
Okay.
I think that's one of the most beautiful pieces of religious literature humanity has. Tremendous honesty and an unflinching desire for like hope, I think, in that, which is funny. But, probably Kafka affected me more than anyone has ever affected me. I think that his stories are just the greatest things that have ever been done by any human. Yeah.
Congratulations, and we can look forward to much, much more now that The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory is out. This memoir is done. It's there for people to see. We can look forward to seeing what else you can come up with by way of telling stories other than from your own traumatic childhood.
Well, yeah, hopefully. Although the next thing I'm working on is a novel. I'm
excellent.
Committed to, settling into a novel. I'm 10,000 words into the first one.
Well,
yeah.
And only half of those will ever see the light.
Yeah. Well, if that's optimistic. It'll be like 200.
Corey, congratulations. Corey White's new book, The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory, a memoir, has brought him here to the studio. You may have seen him on Australian Story. You may have even been to see him at the Melbourne Comedy Festival or elsewhere, which I hope he also continues to do. And now Maz Jobrani, comedian, is touring Australia. He's on at the National Theatre on July the 27th. hang on, what's today? Today's the 16th. Heaps of time to go yet. Lots of time to buy tickets. Maz, welcome to Melbourne. Great to see you.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. How are you?
Well, you're happy to be here because it means you escaped the madness of your homeland just at the moment. What's going on back there? Can you explain it?
I'm telling you. First of all, I'm an immigrant in America. I was born in Iran and I grew up in America. And in the America I grew in, once in a while you would run into some racist guy who would say something like, why don't you go back to your country? And now our president is saying, why don't you go back to your country? And by the way, the tweet that he sent out saying, why don't you go back to your country, three of the women that he was talking about were actually born in America, and the fourth is a citizen. So I'm constantly shaking my head going, is this guy, is he, you know what he's really good at, what he's smart at is not business. He would have been a great PR.
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning. I mean, there's a great documentary. I don't know if you guys have it on the Netflix here, but there's a documentary that there's audio of him calling a reporter for Fortune magazine or whatever, pretending to be his own assistant, saying, this is John Barron, I'm calling for Mr. Trump, and convincing the author to put Mr. Trump into the list of the richest men in the world.
Aggrandizing himself.
One of the things that you mentioned about Trump is he's got a certain persona. And I don't mean this in a flippant way at all.
Yeah.
You've performed in all parts of the world, many parts of the Middle East, and very few other comedians have been as well. There's a certain Gaddafi-esque...
Oh, yes.
Tinge.
Oh, absolutely.
A love of gold, a dictator-esque feeling that he has.
Well, he and Kim Jong-un are both spoiled little babies that grew up with fathers that were powerful, and then they became powerful. So whether it's Kim Jong-un or Gaddafi or, Saddam Hussein, he's definitely – I mean, he gets along with those guys. I mean that's – he seems to be – he comes from that world, right? It is. You're absolutely right.
Did you know there is a Gaddafi Peace Prize?
Whoa.
Can you think of a less appropriate name for
dashiki?
A peace prize?
Did
a Gaddafi Peace Prize. It has just been awarded to which national leader, which country's leader?
Philippines.
No.
Is Mugabe alive?
Hey?
Is Mugabe still alive?
No.
Rwanda?
America?
Turkey. Turkey has just been awarded this week the Gaddafi Peace Prize, which
that's
is kind
delicious.
Of Orwellian. It's like the Saudis being on the Human Rights Committee.
Yeah, I
wonder if that's a prize that Gaddafi gave himself every year. And now that he's no longer around, Erdogan said, I'll take it.
Yeah. his son, the soccer star. Anyway, let's
Well, Trump, I think, wanted the Peace Prize. I think the whole thing he's been trying to do with Korea has been, with North Korea, has been he wants that Peace Prize, which, by the way...
I think he should get it.
You think he should get it?
Absolutely. I think if Henry Kissinger can get the Nobel Peace Prize, so can Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah. Why not? Give it away.
Yeah, at this point.
Truth be told, when Obama got it in the beginning, I thought it was just too early. Like, they gave it to him. He arrived.
He hadn't even started droning Pakistan yet.
So. Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, he hadn't earned that.
Yeah. But no, it is a crazy time right now in the States because and again, you guys were talking about how entertaining it can be for you guys, because for me, I've really tried to not look at his tweets, and then the news reports about the tweets. So then you're pulled back in. It's like Al Pacino in Godfather 3. I keep trying to get up, but they keep pulling me back in. I keep getting pulled. I'm not kidding you guys. Because I've been traveling, I had a few days where I just was not at all in touch with it. And I felt so light and so happy about life.
That's how bad America is right now. Jet lag is blessed.
Jet lag is blessed. That's the name of my book. Jet lag is blessed. Keep me away from Donald Trump. Oh, and then I got into it, and it's crazy because I actually put out a tweet. I said I haven't thought about Donald Trump in the past whatever it was few days, and I said I feel so good. And then this whole thing that happened, and then
he saw your tweet. Basically.
Yeah, well, he probably saw my tweet. He's like, well, I'll get you in.
Yeah.
But then I felt you can't help yourself because you're sitting there going, I don't even know who's going to see my tweets. He's not going to read it. Mm. It's not going to affect him. But I felt like I have to say something. And it's kind of like, you want to believe in karma, But Donald Trump has really made me think it might not exist. It's really testing my belief in this greater power.
So how old were you when you left Iran?
I was 6 years old.
So was that when the Shah was deposed?
Yeah, so we left
the time of the revolution.
Right before, so late 78. Matter of fact, I was just talking to my wife about this. It's interesting because my father had gone on business to New York. And I think a lot of Iranians experienced the same thing. They thought that the Shah would quash the protests and they could come back. So my father sent for my mom to bring my sister and I to New York for our winter break for 2 weeks. And I always said we packed for 2 weeks and we stayed for 40 years. And it happened to a lot of people. And I was just doing the math because my youngest brother is about
Sorry, just on this. Your family were quite well-to-do then back in Iran.
Yes, back in Iran. My father was a successful businessman. He owned an electric company.
So did you lose everything? Did the family have to start again?
My father was one of the people. There was a handful of people that were able to get the money out. And so he came to America very well off.
Right.
And we moved to Northern California, and he bought some property, and he did well with it. But then the early 80s recession hit, and then those properties, he wasn't able to get rid of them. So he basically, my father, he passed away in 2009, and he had lost everything by then. And he actually went back to Iran his last 10 years of his life because he went back to try and do something with the properties he had there. Because I think the Iranian...
Even under the religious government.
Well, the Iranian government realized that when the revolution happened, they had a brain drain as well as a financial drain. So 10 years later, they said, listen, if you were not directly related to the Shah, yeah, come back and we'll let you back. So they let him back and he went there and he left, you know, lived the end of his life there.
Have you been back?
I went back about 20 years ago to visit my father when he was there. And I'll tell you, the people of Iran are beautiful.
Oh, never confuse the people with the government.
Absolutely. And the landscape and all that is beautiful. And I just felt, as someone who grew up in America, I thought, wow, this is a strange existence because, you know, back then it was, you know, you couldn't be walking with a girl in the streets. No. If you walked with somebody in the streets, they could stop you and say, hey, who is this?
Yeah. What are they called? The virtue and vice police.
Yeah, all that stuff. I go, listen, I'm not a 6 year old. I'm a grown man. Like, yeah. Just mind your own business, you know.
And it is their business.
It is their business. Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. And
how you live your life is their business.
It's just mind boggling, you know. And we were talking about this earlier, you know, like Saudi Arabia now is trying to change that image a little bit, you know. So I would hope that – I think with internet and just – I think the world is a lot smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard. It's really hard to keep people oppressed because eventually people will come out. So right now in Iran, there's a lot of women that are taking off the cover and they're filming themselves and putting it online. Mm-hmm. And that's a movement, you know, and I hope that that all leads to more and more freedoms for women.
Sure. But 11 years ago I was in Iran and websites there were completely censored. You couldn't get onto any Western media whatsoever. You got no information about what's going on in the rest of the world. And the population basically just digest what they're given and they're therefore brainwashed.
Well, that's what it is. That's exactly what you were saying earlier when you said Trump is like Gaddafi. I was saying that the America that Trump wants is closer to the totalitarian Iran that we see. You know, when you say fake news, everything you say about me, if you say anything that's bad about me, that must be fake.
That's right.
That sounds like the president and the supreme leader.
And these four Democrats, I mean, they what's their crime? They've criticized his government. That's their offense.
Well, there you go.
Hello, what's wrong with that?
Yeah. Exactly.
You want to live in a country where you can't criticize the government?
Absolutely. And I always say this. When people tell me, you know, when people come at me on social media or something and they go, oh, you should go back to your country or you don't like this country. I go, you know, immigrants, I think, appreciate America more than natural born Americans. Because I go, as a matter of fact, I've had people in the audience get upset at me when I did Trump jokes. I got into a yelling match with a few people when I did some Trump jokes. And one lady wrote me this. I was in Dallas, did the show in Dallas. Shows were great. It was a diverse audience, every background you could imagine. Got an email the next day. You know, we were enjoying the show until you decided to get political. You know, our political leaders deserve our respect. The same way a child deserves your respect, we need to respect our political leaders. And I go, wait a minute. This lady is saying that I should be a child to my leader?
He does call himself Big Daddy, I'm sure.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah.
But, okay, so this isn't new, though, for you, because I first learned about your work back right after George W. Bush decided to invade Iraq and Afghanistan, and this was the early 2000s, and you were part of a troupe called the Axis of Evil comedy tour.
Yes.
And at the time, you were doing comedy about a president who was using patriotism, and you know, and you. I remember seeing video footage of people heckling you because you were daring to criticize Bush.
Yeah.
It's just cycles, isn't it, in America? Is that what it is?
It is cycles. And I feel it's a very interesting thing because I say, look, I didn't do a lot of Obama jokes because, first of all, he didn't say a lot of stupid stuff like that. Maybe you disagree with some of his policies, but sometimes it's hard to take that and turn it into a joke. So,
yeah, really hard time for comedians.
But during Bush, for example, I was making jokes of Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran, because he would also say a lot of outlandish things. But the interesting thing was I had the same thing. I would do a joke about Bush. I was at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles one time. This girl sitting in the front, she goes, "Hey, you can't make fun of our commander-in-chief at a time of war." I go, "Wait a minute. Do you see the irony that this war with Iraq was sold to us as us trying to bring democracy to Iraq, and now you're saying I can't exercise my democratic right of criticizing my president
that's
in America?"
That's why they claim to have gone in.
Yeah.
So you can do that sort of stuff.
Yeah. It's crazy. So I have to remind people, I actually brought back an old joke because I was doing this under the Bush administration, the way I lead into it, because what happened was recently with Trump, and by the way, I got heckled by a lot of immigrants. There was Iranian immigrants who got upset at me when I would do Trump jokes. So,
really?
Yeah. So I had to. So now I found a nice way to kind of handle it with kid gloves. I go, "Guys, listen, you could be Republican, Democrat. I still love you." And this is true. I have friends from both sides. Mm-hmm. I still love you. But I go, the whole point of this country is we can make fun of our leaders. I go, I can't make fun of the president of Iran in Iran. I said, if I made a joke about the president of Iran in Iran, you come up to me after the show and be like, "Hey, when's your next show?" I'll be like, "There are no more shows. The Ministry of No Show showed up."
Yeah.
Right? So I go, let's exercise our free rights. And then I go, "Listen, we all have our own issues." I go, "I have my own issues." I go, "Listen, you might have voted for Trump. That's between you and your therapist." I go, "I got my own issues. Whatever he says pisses me off." Like the other day, I woke up and he had a tweet that said, "Good morning." I go, "This is crap. He's lying again. It's afternoon." So basically, it's an interesting time when you have these people where they get so offended. I go, "I'm not making fun of your grandmother. I'm making fun of this dude that you don't even know. And you might like his policies, but let's call a spade a spade." You know, he tweets too much. He says a lot of stupid crap. And, you know, you were saying he's good for comedy, but in all honesty, it's impossible to keep up with him because he says so much stupid crap every day.
Patton Oswalt's got that bit where he says, while you're writing the punchline for his latest shenanigan, he's done something even bigger, and you're like, "Well, my punchline's useless now. It's not as funny."
Absolutely. I mean, it's because you sit there and you go, I mean, I'll read the headline. I go, "Okay, I got to read this to make sure they're not twisting it." Like when I read the headline, they said he sent out a racist tweet about four congresswomen. I go, maybe he said something that was totally misunderstood. I honestly tried to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, that's interesting. You still have that impulse.
Because I feel like there's so many people that are ready to jump. So I go, let me just see this.
It's interesting that you've maintained that.
I know.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Donald Trump, though, is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, he's just one person, but there's a whole lot of people, millions of your fellow Americans, who agree with him, who support him and voted for him and will again.
Yeah, absolutely.
What does that tell you?
Well, that tells me a few things. First of all, I've been reading a lot. I have my own podcast in the States, and I've been trying to bring in professors. It's called Back to School with Maz Jobrani, and I bring in professors from different backgrounds, and they teach us about different subjects. One of the professors we had was an anthropologist, and we just started talking about the liberal brain versus a conservative brain. And there's articles that have been done about this where it says the liberal brain tends to be a lot more based on hope, and the conservative brain is based on fear. So when you watch the Republican National Convention and Rudy Giuliani is sitting there going, "They're coming to get us, they're coming to get us," and then Trump goes up and says, "I'm the only one that can save us," you know, or when Trump says when he talks about the caravan, the migrants, mm-hmm. there's a caravan coming, and then he wanted to make it really scary. He goes, "There's some unknown Middle Easterners in the caravan," and I'm like, "Well, what's your point of saying that? What are you trying to say? You're saying there's terrorists coming across this border. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the biggest threat to Americans are Americans. You could be in a coffee shop, some guy's going to show up with a gun and go nuts." So the fact is, I think that obviously there's different people that are wired differently. I could talk till I'm blue in the face, and they're still going to think that I'm out to get them.
But the same look at Brexit, same thing. Fear of immigration, the African and Middle Eastern, particularly the Syrian refugees, yeah. the exodus, the swamping, you know, the Eastern Europeans, Hungary, Poland, yeah. all of those countries, they've all gone down the same path.
Yeah.
It's not just America. This is a global phenomenon here in Australia. We had a surprise election result, and that whole fear thing was a factor in part of the policy settings here as well.
Yeah. My hope is in the long run, because I have young kids. I have an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old, and they just seem a lot more evolved than I am. Even when we have conversations, they seem to be a lot more open-minded than I was at their age. And so my hope is that, yes, I think we go up and down, up and down. But I hope that in the long run, we're heading towards more being more progressive. I hope
progress is neither inevitable nor linear.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we've taken it for granted. We've grown up, in particular since World War II, and then right through the whole of the Vietnam era and the challenging of authority and figures of position in yeah. society, whether it's religious institutions. And here in Australia, we've had a crisis with our banks, as you did in the States. People in positions of previously unchallenged authority have been shown to disappoint us.
Yeah.
And so people are looking for other ways of trying to order society. And the idea that progress just keeps happening, no, it doesn't. No. It happens because people make it happen, because they fight, they argue, they establish a case, they build momentum, they explain what's going on.
So do you,
that's how you get progress.
Do you, John, do you agree with Martin Luther King when he said the arc of more, what is it, the exact wording? The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Yes.
Or do you think we have to bend it ourselves?
No, you nudge it.
Along
you nudge
way.
It. So yeah. you can't ask people to do U-turns, just like you can't get oil tankers to do U-turns
yeah.
in the Iranian Gulf. And you also, oh, did
Thank
you like
you.
The way
to yes, that? Yeah. Yes.
And you can nudge society, yeah. you can nudge opinion, you can nudge belief.
You know, I heard when Obama did a podcast and he was being interviewed, and he said, you know, he goes, racism obviously exists. But he goes, when we look back 50 years in America and where we've come, he goes, we have made a lot of progress. And it's kind of like what you were saying. I do agree with you. I think we do need to nudge it forward. But I do also feel I see younger people. Again, I see my kids. I mean, our neighbors were an African-American father and a white mother. And I was talking to my wife and I said, yeah, this, that, the other. I go, you know, Kevin is black and Anne is white. And then my kids, their jaws dropped. And I looked at him and I said, what's wrong? They go, you said black. I go, yeah, they're black. He goes, no, they're African-American. I go, what? And it was this awakening in my mind that I go, oh, my God, these guys are even more evolved than I am, mm-hmm. even with just a tiny thing like that use the proper terminology. So I do feel you're right. We do need to nudge it forward. But I do feel it's inevitable that these people will be exposed. Like right now, America is too late. If you want to kick out the brown people, it's too late. We've arrived. And without us, your food would suck. So get used to it, right? I say, you're the rice, we're the spice. You got Indian, Chinese, Iranian, Pakistani, I don't care. And by the way, that's another thing I do encourage people all the time is I say, go to a restaurant from another land.
Experience the culture.
Experience the
food. Yeah.
And just see the people.
It's easy to hate those people you've never met.
Absolutely.
It's easy to think the Jews, the Muslims, the Italians, or whoever it might be, they're the ones who are to blame. If you've never actually broken bread with people, which is why community links, grassroots, neighborhood, all of that stuff is so important.
Absolutely.
Because it challenges all those hate messages.
Yeah. And I think that we are so isolated in America from the rest of the world that a lot of people don't travel. And I think that's one thing that Australians do well. You guys travel well.
Well, we have to, don't we?
You have to, because you guys get, what, 4 weeks for your holiday? Is that what you get?
Or more.
We get 2 weeks vacation. We don't have time to travel.
So the best thing we could do for the United States would be to have more holidays.
I am on board.
Reform American society and global geopolitics by creating more holidays.
More holidays.
And make passports cheaper for American citizens.
Yeah. Well, they might turn around and say, these immigrants are trying to make the holidays longer. I actually think the word holiday is a more pleasant term than vacation.
Vacation sounds like it's very businessy. It's like vacation. Holiday is like holiday.
It ends in a smile. Holiday.
It's holiday in, not vacation in.
You're right.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Maz Jobrani is touring Australia. He's on at the National Theatre on the 27th of July. The 27th of July at the National Theatre. You don't want to miss it. Corey White. You ever thought of changing your name? You don't really want to be White, do you?
White.
Pauline Hanson said it's okay to be White, and Corey is all right.
Yeah, that's next year's comedy show. It's okay to be Corey White.
It's not very woke.
No, not woke at all. But as we've been discussing, there's the backlash. Corey, there's money to be made in backlash.
Corey Caucasian.
Yeah. Yeah, something like this.
The prettiest horse in the glue factory is the name of his memoir, and Sammy Shah has been
Sammy
my
Brown.
Sammy King has been my invaluable co-host. Corey Caucasian, also known as Corey White, is the author of The Prettiest Horse in the Glue Factory. Maz Brown, also known as Maz Jobrani, is on tour at the National Theatre on the 27th. Sammy, thank you for coming too.
On ABC Radio, this is The Conversation Hour.